And we welcome you back, everyone. I'm Alec Green, in for Harold Fisher tonight. On Insight tonight, from a Dallas cop convicted of murder to bloodshed on D.C.'s streets to paying college athletes, tonight our Reporters Roundtable sheds light on these top stories of the week. And let's welcome our panel this evening, Lauren Poteet, Washington correspondent with the National Newspaper Association, Dr. Natalie Hopkins, Howard University Assistant Professor with the Department of Communications, Culture, and Media Studies, and on the phone with us, Richard Fowler, contributor with Fox News Network. Thank you all for joining us on Insight this evening. We welcome you to the program. All right, first up, let's take the big story of the day. Really, we heard around the 5 o'clock hour, this story we can't seem to stop talking about out of Dallas. Amber Guyger tonight, now in prison, serving her sentence for murdering a man named Botham John in his apartment. 10 years for this ex-cop. Lauren, you want to start on just giving some thoughts on what you've been hearing?
I'm so glad that she got convicted. I know some people are upset that it wasn't longer, which it should be longer because this man is dead, so you can't really put a price on someone's life. But I am so glad that she is convicted and going to jail, because my concern was that she wouldn't get convicted and be able to get off on the whole Doctrine Castle.
Yeah, which basically is similar to the stand your ground law. The judge allowed it. But the prosecutors vehemently argued against it, because basically she was not inside her home. She wasn't standing her ground inside her home.
And the fact that the judge allowed it just speaks to the issues within the justice system, just on a whole separate issue. But had she not gotten convicted, it would have set a precedent in the country where white supremacists could then feel comfortable going into black people's homes and murdering them, because that's essentially what happened with the Trayvon Martin case. Zimmerman didn't get convicted. And then you just see this circus of mass shootings among black people. So I'm really glad that she got convicted. I mean, she could have stood to get longer, but I'm just so glad that she got what she got.
Yeah, there were protests outside the courtroom of people shouting, no justice, no peace, that sort of thing. I want to make sure that our listeners take part in this conversation. So give us a call and give us your thoughts, your comments at 202-319-7810. That's 202-319-7810. Please give us a call and talk to us about any of these topics that we're talking about tonight. Richard Fowler, I want to get your thoughts on the sentencing of Amber Guyger.
Well, thanks for having me. I mean, one thing I want to say, this is before we get to the negative of the fact that she only got 10 years, let's talk about the positive here. The positive here is this jury found this police officer guilty of murdering this man, which is a shock, right? This is a stunning news development, because we're not used to this in this country. We're used to police officers engaging in these type of crimes and then walking. So that's the good news here. And the other, I think, the point of about civic participation, is that this is why it's so important that when you get your jury duty notice in the mail, you go down to the courthouse and you don't try to skip out on jury duty, because then you could be the change that you want to seek. The sad part here is that after killing this man in cold blood, who was sitting in his apartment eating a bowl of ice cream, she's only getting 10 years, where if it was on the other foot, right, if it was a black man who had shot a police officer, they'd probably be in jail for life. And so I think that's the part that is heartrending. But the positive here is, finally, this is a sea change in this country, that is now police know they will be held accountable when they engage in bad behavior, just like every other citizen would.
The number to call, 202-319-7810, to join the conversation here. Reporters Roundtable assembled, 202-319-7810. Dr. Natalie Hopkins, there was emotional testimony from the family during the sentencing phase. We heard from Botham John's family, the mother, of course, talking about, you know, the pain that she feels. I want to play for you, though, the victim's brother, Brant John, who said this in court.
I don't even want you to go to jail. I want the best for you, because I know that's exactly what both of them would want you to do. And the best would be give your life to Christ.
That's pretty stunning. And Brant John then went up to Amber Guyger, hugged her, and tears could be heard in the courtroom while the two of them embraced. What do you think, Dr. Natalie?
I think that when you've gone through something like that, you don't need me or anybody else to judge how you respond. However, I do think that, you know, this is part of, like, this is pretty typical. I mean, sort of putting this woman's life, you know, above, and her happiness and her white tears are sort of centered in this. Mm-hmm. How is it about how she feels? You know, how does this, and it's, you know, that's sort of like typical. As soon as I saw her, you know, with her blonde look and all the tears, the defense really decided to make the choice to put her out there and have her tearfully crying and you know, talking about, like, all of a sudden she's a victim in this. Like, how are you a victim in this? This man was eating his ice cream. You know, so it is very good-hearted, and I'm sure, you know, this brother will, you know, make it to heaven and, you know, all of that. But that doesn't really serve the justice system as a whole. And, you know, and I do think that this is, you know, I was shocked by it. I've become so numb from all of these horrible verdicts over time that I expected nothing. I wasn't even looking in because I didn't want to even set myself up for disappointment. Yeah. So I think it's a good start. It's like a start. Like, there's so many more murders that are never held, so many more officers who are never held account for their actions. And, you know, maybe they might think twice, some of them.
202-319-7810. I want to take some listeners' calls here. Will, calling in from Dallas. Hi, Will.
Hey, how you doing, family? Hey, Millette, at one time I did live right there in PG County, so I'm out in Dallas now. It's a little mixed emotional out here, but if you look at, like the gentleman said, there is a lot of positive that came out of this, and you have to give a thumbs up to the family. If they can forgive, we can forgive. That's how close this thing was to them. It's letting the police free reign out here to kill anymore. So hopefully there was a message that went out worldwide to let police know, hey, we're going to start holding you accountable for what you do.
Well, thank you for your comments. We really appreciate it. I want to get another comment in. I believe this is Terry calling in from Maryland. What do you want to say about the Geiger case?
Hi, yes. It really saddens me that the judge, being an African-American woman herself, that she allowed that. I forgot what it's called, but I feel like...
You're talking about the judge in the case?
The Castle Doctrine?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes, thank you. I don't think that should have been allowed.
Mm-hmm.
He was in his own apartment. What I take from this, I always lock my doors. I'm just shaking my head.
Yeah.
I don't know what else to say.
Thank you, Terry, for calling in with your comments. I think a lot of people feel so many emotions, as the caller said, about this case. And we'll continue to talk about it and use it as a test case for other cases that unfortunately we'll hear about in the court system. I want to talk about crime that is impacting the nation's capital in a big way and sends a strong message as well. Today we heard from some moms who are demanding action. That's the name of the group, Moms Demand Action. And they gave D.C.'s mayor an earful. The mayor announced that she has more resources coming to help curb the violence. First, let's play what the mayor had to say
to this group. If you're shot in Ward 8, there's no trauma center. You have to travel all the way up to Howard or Washington Hospital Center. That time travel makes a difference. Grievance centers, we don't have any grievance centers. There's nothing there that after the pain, what happens next. The cameras that they talk about that are outside, half of them don't work, so we need them to aggregately work. We need the community to step up.
And there you heard, that wasn't actually the mayor. That was from a representative of Moms Demand Action talking about the resources that they demand that the city implement and utilize to help with this violence in the city. I want all of you to talk about this issue, and because it could be any major city, but it happens to be our capital city we're dealing with in this issue. Lauren, you want to start?
So I'm not opposed to the idea of extra officers patrolling these neighborhoods, because oftentimes when I do go to these very affluent areas in D.C., you have all of these cops, and they're not really needed to be there. And then when you go to the areas that are a little more dangerous, you hardly see any. So I'm not opposed to the idea of more officers. My only concern is, where are these officers coming from? Are these community officers? Are they from D.C.? Are they familiar with the wards and the people? Because if they're outside cops coming in doing late night patrol, my concern is they will stereotype or project internal views onto innocent people. So that's my only concern.
All right. Dr. Natalie Richard Fowler, what do you have to say about this? I know one of the questions peppered to the police chief is that his force is increasingly becoming white and unrelatable in many of these communities and neighborhoods where, you know, the people are African-American and are often poor and from disadvantaged circumstances. And the relatability factor is a big challenge for this police department. Richard, you want to start?
Listen, I think there's two things on this that's really important to realize. I think number one, and I think I'm happy that Moms Demand Action has been in Washington, D.C. talking about this issue, because it's about the proliferation of illegal guns on our streets, number one. I think number two, and more importantly, we've really got to figure out how we do community policing better. How do we create rebuild the trust that exists between police departments and communities of color? And that starts by having real conversations. And that also starts by recruiting folks who live in these communities to eventually become police officers, right? We can't have a community. We need police to protect our communities, but we also need communities that are able to trust the police, and those two things have to exist together. And I think this is not only the fight in our nation's capital where I live, but it's also the fight all across the country where you see folks having these type of conversations.
Dr. Natalie.
I agree completely with that, and I would also add that when the woman spoke about, from Moms Demand Action, she talked about the fact that there was no trauma center in Ward 7 and 8. And so when you're talking about resources to sort of deal with these issues, we shouldn't always just equate it with police. You know, this is how we got to when the days when D.C. was called the murder capital, that's how we ended up with mass incarceration. Like, we have to learn from the past, and we have to think about carefully, like, what does that mean? Resources does not mean just throwing more police out there. Mm-hmm. You know, it means investing in communities and investing in prevention, investing in peace work.
I think that's a very good point. Okay, let me go back to the phone lines. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Donald calling in from Boston. Hey, Donald, what do you want to say?
Yes, good evening. I'm actually a native Washingtonian, but I moved to Boston about 30 years ago.
So okay.
Uptown Northwest when it was really Chocolate City. But I know the place has changed.
Okay, so what do you want to say, Donald?
I just wanted to say that I was definitely surprised she got convicted. I thought murder was, even though it was murder, I thought they had charged her a little too harshly, if that's all the jury had to choose from. And then I was even more appalled by that judge giving that information to the jury, what they could choose about the similar stand your ground situation. But it was definitely a good thing that she got convicted, but I think we want to be a little cautious of thinking this is a sea change. You know, I think this is a speed bump, but I really don't think it's going to really change the dynamics of police killing black youths or black gentlemen at all. So I think we just want to be a little cautious of it, but I think this is a good...
Thank you, Donald. Thank you very much. All right, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. That's the number to call. Once we go to break and we switch over to Sirius, you'll still be able to hear the conversation when you call in on Sirius XM Channel 141. I know we want to talk about the student athletes, and we're going to get to that California Fair Pay to Play Act. I want to get your thoughts on that before we go to break. Do we have time to do that, or do we need to take the break now? All right, so we'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll get right to that. We're going to take a break and go to the original Quiet Storm with Jeff Brown on the WHUR side. But give me a call, because I want to hear your viewpoints about this California law to pay college athletes. I'm Alec Green, and for Harold Fisher. So much for staying with us here on the Daily Drums Insight segment. I'm Alec Green, in for Harold Fisher tonight. Our Reporters Roundtable is fired up, and we're talking about a whole bunch of things tonight. Lauren Poteet is here, Dr. Natalie Hopkins, Richard Fowler, and let's get to the California Governor Gavin Newsom, pretty confident about this California Fair Pay to Play Act. College athletes, should they be getting paid? Okay, so Richard, I want to start with you on this. What are you hearing out there?
Listen, this college athlete thing is a pretty simple take to me. These athletes make universities billions of dollars, mm-hmm. not millions, billions of dollars, and they don't see one penny of it. And a lot of these athletes don't make it pro. So they don't make it pro. The university makes millions off them, and then they leave college without being able to get that money back. So I'm all for paying these college students because they deserve it, and they deserve the right to get paid for their work, period.
I think a lot of people have a lot to say about this. Okay, Lauren, let me take you.
So today I actually got to speak with Clyde Daughtry, the director of intercollegiate athletics at Bowie State University, and their head coach, Daryl Brooks. Mm-hmm. And they both share the same sentiments that Richard just spoke about. So you have these students who... You have these people in charge, these coaches who make millions of dollars every year, and then you have these struggling students.
The coaches, the programs,
correct.
The colleges, so many people making so much money, but the college athletes are not.
And the athletes are the only ones in these institutions who can't go out and make extra money.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's important that they're able to sustain themselves. I mean, if the money isn't coming from the institutions. The money is coming from these students' promotions that they do using their likeness. And one of the issues that was discussed was that, well, maybe California might get kicked out of the NCAA because right. of the stance mm-hmm. he took. I think California has to date the most winnings within the NCAA. And as Clyde Dowdy stated, you know, it doesn't work like that. So the NCAA is made up of a team, of a board of people, and they have to vote on these things. So the idea that they'll kick California out is implausible. This doesn't take effect until 2023. So there is still time to kind of revoke the idea or alter it or change it. But I think that the precedent that it's setting is remarkable, and that, you know, more states should back it so that it goes through 2023.
202-319-7810. That's the number to call to join in the conversation. 202-319-7810. Dr. Natalie?
Yes, I agree completely. As the mother of a Division I college athlete, mm-hmm. I think that they absolutely should be able to. I mean, it's sort of like, I mean, there's many writers have sort of likened the NCAA college system to a plantation, you know, where you're working and you're not getting any of the things. They work hard. They're traveling constantly. They can't work for a living, and they can't work to support themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think it's absolutely just for them to do that. And I mean, I think California has just been getting it in lately. I mean, they've been sort of leading the nation in all these different areas, from rent control. And, you know, I'm just really impressed with some of the policies that are coming out. And I hope that they have, you know, given how big they are in the NCAA world, that they will encourage other states to do the same.
It was a power move, for sure.
Yeah, it definitely was. Let's go to our phone lines at 202-319-7810 and see what our listeners have to say. I believe this is Joseph calling in from the district. Joseph,
yes,
which topic do you want to talk about?
Ward 8 and the Achilles.
Okay.
What I would say to that is, I think that the police would never be as effective with the youth and the communities today as much as someone who has been rehabilitated, has been to jail, and has come out and rehabilitated themselves, to walk around and just get affiliated with the kids in the neighborhood. You know, I'm a nurse now, and I work at one of the psych hospitals. And what we do is we're very effective because we're present. We're up close mm-hmm. with the patients that are there. I think that if they would hire some people who have been incarcerated, train them to be hire them specifically for that purpose, to walk the streets and to get to know the people and be visible. I think that that's the only way that things are going to change, because the kids don't respect the police; they're afraid of them, you know. And so they can be one way one day, and then once they leave, they're back to the old thing. But to hire
that's a really
ex-con.
That's a really good point. That's a really good point. And I love it. There are programs already that have ex-convicts who are rehabilitated and want to go back into the community and give back. And we see those results. And Joseph, that's a good point. Maybe the police chief and others are listening and they can hear that. And maybe they'll institute some of that on their force or as part of their programs. Thank you for that, Joseph. All right. I want to go to Kathy calling in from the district. Hi, Kathy. What do you want to talk about tonight?
I want to talk about community policing, and I want to just thank you for the myriad of really important topics. This is really a thought-provoking show, and I'm happy to share my thoughts. I live in the district in Ward 5, mm-hmm. and we have an excellent relationship with the police in Patrol Service Area 507, and even officers that work in other places that actually come over to help with crime. We have community walks.
Mm-hmm.
We take pictures with them. We interact with them. And we have a meaningful relationship. And when people complain about the police, it's really a function of citizen inactivity because the police work for us. So if you're unhappy with the way the police are patrolling your community, citizens need to step up and really start working with the police and giving, you know, and give them communication and feedback on what they could do better. And I find that the chief listens, and sometimes you have to tell them things that they don't want to hear, but it's necessary. And over the years, I've served my community for 20 years, and we have a stronger relationship with the police. Citizens provide information about people who commit crimes, and I'd like to see that replicated throughout every ward in this city.
Lauren, let me hear you address Kathy's perspective and thoughts.
You know, I think community policing is a good idea. It's a good initiative, and I think if done properly, it can work. But, you know, community policing won't stop an officer who just doesn't like you because of the color of your skin from pulling out his gun and shooting you. So I feel like this issue falls more on the hands of the actual officers and making sure that the officers are properly trained. Again, officers that are from the community, familiar with the community, knowing the people. Like, I would lean more towards more officer training, better officer training, and then stronger repercussions for not following the strict guidelines.
Richard, jump in here.
No, I think it goes beyond just, I mean, here's the problem. I mean, community policing does work, but it only works in a situation where there's actual trust that exists between communities and police. And I think that is part of the larger problem that we have, not only in Washington, D.C., but across this country, is you have communities of color that do not trust that the police have their best interests at hand. So you can't have a community policing system where they're walking the block until you first deal with the fact that there's no trust that exists between communities of color and police departments. When you get the trust there, then community policing works. Look at a city like Trenton, where they've actually worked on rebuilding trust. So now their community policing arm works perfectly. A city like Alexandria, just south of Washington, D.C., the same. They built up trust first, and then community policing worked effectively. And so there has to be a trust element, and that has to come before you say we're just going to implement a community policing program in our community, and it's going to solve all the problems.
Thank you. I want to thank Kathy for her perspective, and I grew up in Ward 5, my mother and father, they still live in Ward 5, so I know Ward 5 very well, and Ward 5 is vastly different than Ward 7 and 8 in terms of the relationship that the community has with the police. That is very true. And Dr. Monica, I would love to get your perspective on this and what you're hearing in terms of what we need to do about certain areas of the city. Because these wards are different. They have a different personality.
They are, but I mean, I live in Ward 5, and I would say there isn't a lot of trust in Ward 5 either. So, you know, one thing that I would like to push back a little bit on is this idea is that the onus is on the community, and that's a failure of the community to police the police.
Yeah, that was very strong.
Yeah, that's not how this whole thing works. They serve us. They have to do better. They have to put in the work to do in the relationship. And what I see is I see a lot of people from outside the city who are coming in. They're very young. They don't know a lot about the culture of D.C. They're very arrogant. and they are uninterested in really connecting with the residents that are around. And so they really need to do a lot better about that. And they also need to do better. I mean, there's a lot of distrust because there's reason to it's for cause, you know? So I think the onus is on them. But again, I just don't think that all of the resources and the attention should be around policing. You know, we have a prison culture because people think that that is the answer. You know, when you have a conflict with another person, there isn't time to have the police come and intervene. And so, you know, it has to be something that's much more foundational to like the way that communities work. And that's how those investments need to be made to make us all safer.
And then we can't just confine this problem to the district. I mean, over in Hyattsville, just over the line, a lot of people are uneasy about what just happened, where you had 10 officers from several police departments shoot a man named Leonard Chand. The police say Chand rushed at an officer with two knives, and there was that clear threat, and they responded with the 10 officers shooting and killing this man, who many say had mental challenges. Anybody want to address that first, Lauren?
I mean, I can't give you specifics, but you hear about cases all the time overseas where these things happen. You have people who have mental health issues and the officers detain them. They do things to detain them, but it's not excessive force. They're not killing. So you have one man and 10 officers killing one man. I mean, at what point do people as a whole, because we are in charge, it's up to us. So at what point do people as a whole come together and just say, you know what, we've had enough of this police brutality? I don't want to get like, you know, I don't want to advocate violence on the radio show, but mm-hmm. I mean, at what point do we defend ourselves, come together and defend ourselves and just, you know, take it into our own hands and defend ourselves against police brutality?
That's a strong statement, Lauren. Okay. The number to call is 202-319-7810. I think a lot of people feel exactly the way that statement came out of your mouth. Like, what do we do to protect ourselves from the police? I want to bring in Alfonso from the district to this conversation. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I want to talk about both of the issues about the police shooting and about the violence in the district.
Okay, go ahead.
First, about the violence in the district, I think what a lot of people look over is where it starts from. And I know you commented something about the mothers against violence. Well, there's a lot of mothers raising these boys. I came to the district in 07, and every time I would have an issue with a young lady that I was dealing with, the first thing they would say, I'm going to go get my son. So that has a lot to do with it, and the fact that we're not giving these young men any hope. When you're waking up hungry, when you're waking up with holes in your underwear, no place to
that goes back to Dr. Nadley's comment about resources too, and making sure we bring resources. What's the other issue you want to bring up real quick before we go to break?
Okay, the other issue is about the young man who forgave the Geiger, the former police officer.
Yes, the brother of the victim. Mm-hmm.
Right. We as black people, I don't know where we get that from, putting other people ahead of ourselves, ahead of our lives. We got to get past that. You know, that's his brother. That's his brother, and he got a right to grieve the way he wants to, but we as a whole, as black people, we'll put someone else before our own lives, and we got to get a grip on that.
Alfonso, thank you so much for your thoughts this evening. I appreciate your time. All right. This is the Insight segment on WHUR's Daily Drum. I'm Alec Green, in for Harold Fisher. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back and continue our Reporters Roundtable. Welcome back, everyone, to the Daily Drum's Insight segment. We're still talking, and I want to follow up on our last caller, Alfonso, who called in to talk about the violence in Ward 7 and 8, particularly where the police chief is going to deploy many more officers to try to curb the violence. And that man who called in, Alfonso, talked about part of the problem being mothers raising sons. And I know Dr. Natalie Hopkinson, you had this conversation in class, you said, with your students.
We did.
So, okay, tell me how that went and what's their perspective on this? Because we hear this kind of angle a lot.
So, you know, we're talking about we're reading Kimberly Crenshaw and Patricia Hill Collins' Black Feminist Theory, and they talk about this sort of the demonization of Black women, the demonization of Black mothers in particular. And there's a long line of this where all of the problems in our community trace back to the Black woman, and that is sort of like sort of a fallacy. Like, we're one community. We all come from a man and a woman. There's no such thing as a child that doesn't have a father. There's always a father. if there's no father involved, there's no mm-hmm. child, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. you know? And so these are one of the ways that are these things that help us to make us think that we are deficient.
Yeah.
There's something that's wrong with us. When in fact, these are trends that the same levels of single parent, female led households that Robert Moynihan pointed to in the 1960s. That's where white families are now. And there's nothing wrong with, and the white woman isn't to blame for anything. You know, that's just the way that the society is moving. You know, people have also, you know, Black families, we have alternate ways of family. Maybe they're not married, but they're still supportive. There's studies that show that Black men are actually more involved in their children's lives than white men are. You know, so, you know, these are some of the myths that we try to push back on, because it's really destructive, you know, and it's sort of the blaming women and, you know, and as if that we're separate and our fates aren't intertwined.
Richard?
I tend to agree with that. I mean, I was raised by a single mother, so there's nothing. I worship and adore Black women. And I think this notion, this idea that they're part of the problem is not only ridiculous, but it's laughable. Because here's the truth. When you look in communities of color, when you look in our community, what you see is this. You see underfunded schools. You see schools with 38 kids in the kindergarten class. You see schools with no librarians, no school nurses, no social workers, no guidance counselors. And then you say, oh, well, if it's a Black woman's fault that the kids aren't doing well, maybe it's the fact that when your kids go to school, we're not putting the resources in the schools they deserve. And I think anybody who would blame Black women for the problems in this community without looking at the fact that sometimes our leadership is not serving us well, they're problematic as well. And, you know, that's one of the things. And I want to say to every caller listening tonight that if you grew up in this idea that Black single family homes or single mother homes are broken homes, that is also a farce, because the only home is broken is the home there's no love there. And that's what a broken home looks like. And the fact that we blame single mothers and single Black mothers who work their behinds off to take care of their children for the problems in our community is laughable.
White people walk away too. That's the first thing I want to say. The second thing is, what does this have to do with white cops, white supremacists, killing innocent Black men? What are you talking about? You're saying the reason why it's the woman's fault. What does it have to do with white supremacists killing innocent Black men?
Or Black on Black crime.
Or Black on Black crime. Well,
which is another fallacy. That's a word that I ban in our department. There's no such thing. There's white people kill white people because white people live around white people. Black people kill Black people because we're segregated. So that created a whole category like it's a thing. Mm-hmm. It's not a thing. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, the caller was talking about the violence, the epidemic of violence in D.C. specifically.
The gun violence.
Yes,
the bloodshed.
The gun
seeing.
Violence. Yeah.
But I just want to be clear. So Black men are important. We know that. And so you're saying, like, Black women need, you know, Black families, there needs to be a Black man. Okay, well, there will be if you stop killing them.
Or there has to be a Black, also it was sort of like, there has to be a Black man leading it, or else it's not legitimate, or they're destined for trouble.
I'm trying to play off of the concern
right.
that there are no Black men. If they're so important, why are you killing them? If you care so much, why are you killing them?
And incarcerating them.
And incarcerating
well.
Them. And they are important, but you don't really care about that.
Richard, what are you saying?
And it's beyond just like the killing of them. It's the fact that immediately, at the moment that a Black man comes out the womb, we're automatically victimized. We're victimized from kindergarten to the time we get to third. We walk into a class, we do something, a white student will chew gum. They'll get stopped on the risk. A Black student chews gum. A Black male student chews gum. He's going to be suspended for 5 days. So the victimization starts immediately. And then you're asking yourself the question, why aren't they in the household? They're in the household because their entire lives have been victimized because of a system of white supremacy. And beyond just that, by the fact that we live in this, it's a systemic problem. And until we address that problem, you can't blame Black women for being the head of household and doing a damn good job at it.
Well, don't ask why Black men aren't in the household if your actions show us that you don't really care. because now you're just kind of patronizing me. That's my point.
And just actually just pointing the finger and you sort of demonizing and you know, saying, okay, this is the source of the problem, when actually this is the source. This is how we're still here.
I want to go back to the top story that we addressed, the Amber Geiger case, and just try to lay out some points that we need to kind of take with us as this case is going to be continued to be studied, and as we dissect other cases that could be similar to this. Okay, so she could have gotten up to 99 years in prison. She was given, the jury decided on a 10-year sentence. The judge read that sentence to her, and she is now sitting in prison serving her time. It also was revealed during, I believe, the sentencing phase that she exchanged racist text messages and really bad social media posts, which kind of shed light on her character. I want you guys to kind of, Richard, I want you to start first and lay out one or two points that we need to kind of take away from this entire case that has captivated national, international attention. Richard?
Point number one, when you get the jury notice in the mail, go to jury duty. People of color, black people, go to jury duty. We make a difference on the jury. We are just as much their peers as anybody else. That's number one. I think point number two is, as well, this is only, it was only a 10-year sentence. It was a step in the right direction, right? In that a police officer was held accountable for shooting a black man while he was sitting in his apartment eating ice cream. Which the reason why I repeat that is because it's insane. This man was bothering no one, eating ice cream in his house, and he was still shot by the police.
And the fact of the matter is, many people were relieved and kind of surprised that she did get the guilty verdict to murder, when she could have, the jury had an option for other lesser conviction options there. Continue, Richard.
I think that's absolutely right. And the fact that the Castle Doctrine or the Stand Your Ground Law was even an out is laughable to me. Mm-hmm. You weren't in your castle. You weren't in your ground. You walk into this man's house, and then you shot him. And even going back to my previous one about victimization, think about this. She saw him, and then she immediately said she didn't assume he was a janitor. She didn't assume he was a repairman. She automatically assumed that he was a burglar, which speaks to the fact that how black men are portrayed by
demonized
police officers it determines the outcomes that we have.
All right. Thank you so much for that. Okay, Lauren, what are the takeaways?
White people lie. I don't believe that she believed he was a burglar. That's the first thing. Like, I just don't believe that. I never did. So she shot him because that's what she wanted to do. Also, the takeaways are that just because you...
And to stop you for that, when she testified in court and the prosecution asked her point blank, was your intention to kill? She said yes.
Right.
She shot him
through
the
heart. So she tried, convicted, you know, and sentenced him in 2 minutes.
She did.
So the crime was burglary, and the sentence was death. And she openly admitted that in the courtroom.
Interrupted your takeaways.
No,
I'm sorry.
It's okay. Which makes the Castle Doctrine that much more problematic, which is my second takeaway, is that just because you are black physically doesn't make you black internally, because what was that judge thinking to even throw that on the table?
Well, some people say that, you know, it sort of made it appeal proof, you know, so that there won't be, you know, it sort of.
And I consider that.
Yeah.
But it's just like, I just wouldn't have been that judge to do that. Do you know what I mean? I'm like, okay, I hear what you're saying, but yeah, I can't be the one to do that.
Well, the prosecution was clearly ready to tear that argument to shreds, as they did in court. Any other takeaways before we move on to Dr. Natalie? Okay, Dr. Natalie, what are the bigger takeaways?
Well, the other thing, just, you know, I have students where they're doctoral students studying communication, and one thing that they brought up was they watching the Black Lady sketch show, where they had, there was a skit where there's...
Oh, you're talking about the show that's on HBO?
Yeah.
Okay,
where they had the skit where there was a black court, black judge, black bailiff, black everybody, and then they were doing the black dance. They said that was sort of a version of this in this case, because there were so many, you had a black judge, you had black prosecutors, you had, you know, it's also showed that, like, there's a difference, you know, when we're in the room. So, you know, just as we're talking about making sure that we serve jury duty, you know, also get involved. You know, that was what was so beautiful, beautiful backlash of the Trump election was that you had so many black judges being and black women judges being elected. And, you know, they're not like not the high level, you know, high profile races, but, in the local, these local matters really make a difference. And so I choose to be, you have to be encouraged by that. This is a step in the right direction.
Yeah, that's what Richard said at the beginning, and it is a step in the right direction, because this case, I just can't even imagine what we would be seeing and experiencing if the verdict went in a whole different direction, if a not guilty verdict came down. I want to thank you all for the fantastic discussion tonight. Thank you so much for joining us, Lauren Poteet, Dr. Natalie Hopkinson, and Richard Fowler. Thank you all for your expertise and shedding your sharing your thoughts this evening. And, of course, we want you to come back again. Reporters Roundtable will do this again one day soon. I'm Mollette Green, and for Harold Fisher this evening on the Daily Drums Insight segment. All right. Thank you all. We'll see you next time.
Is it rude to say?